Question number two, and what did the presidents and princes find fault against Daniel? Only in the law of God. What was the royal statute made by them? And what did Daniel do when this writing was signed? Just as was his custom. Why did the king not spare Daniel from the lion's den? Question six. Yep. Could not change it. And why was no manner of hurt found upon Daniel? What had happened to keep Daniel from being hurt? Yep. And what became of the men that accused Daniel? And leading into tonight's discussion, so where we're at, who is the king that we were talking about here? What king is this? There is. So tonight, the book is not chronological, so now we're skipping back Belshazzar for the events of tonight. Now, Daniel chapter 6 is a really interesting chapter, and it's also a very misunderstood chapter. Very often misused, and usually, at least from what I've seen, trying to look at these things that people come up with this chapter, it seems like they're just missing a couple little things. And is this so often the case when you miss one thing, or you know, fail to read something properly, it can cascade into other things? And tonight we're going to look at the vision of the four beasts, the mentioning of some of those misunderstandings that they use this chapter to go into some other things. This actually is on orange when driving home each day. I pass the sign every day, coming home from work. Saturday, the true Lord's day, changed by the Antichrist. And it quotes Daniel chapter 7, verse 25. And of course, as you can see, it's 7 to 8 guys that are putting this up. And actually, I think they have another one on the other side with another thing. Does this chapter teach this? You know, what is this teaching? You know, there's a verse. They're quoting a verse. And when you read it, it says something about changing something. We're going to look at that tonight. First, we're going to go through and look at, verse by verse, what this chapter is actually talking about. Rough outline of the chapter, roughly broken down into three sections. The first 8 verses describing these visions of these four beasts that he sees. Next section, the vision of the Ancient of Days and the kingdom. And then we get an interpretation, which all these in this chapter kind of blend together somewhat when we're looking at this. Well, when we're getting into this, as after we pray through this chapter, what do we know initially? I think we should kind of try to take a step back and we've read the chapter perhaps and we don't know anything and this is maybe confusing to us. Let's consider a couple things right up front. First of all, when we're reading through this, as we'll go through it, we'll notice that there's some similarities here to Daniel chapter 2. And hopefully that will help us understand it. We're actually told in verse 17, these four beasts are representing four kings. And in verse 25, it tells us that the saints of the Most High shall intend to. Shall be given into his hand for a certain period of time. And that the saints are part of an everlasting kingdom. I'm kind of getting ahead, but just to kind of frame it, particularly that first part. Okay, so let's look at the first few verses of chapter 7. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions of his head while on his bed. Then he wrote down the dream, telling the main facts. Daniel spoke, saying, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. Okay, now granted, and I'm presuming we read the chapter, but we already know that, you know, we're going to have a lot of visions. One of the things that's going to be important is trying to figure out, you know, what's literal? Is this, you know, what's symbolic? Well, when we first read this, okay, he's having a vision, and he sees a vision by night, and there's four winds of heaven, or stirring up the great sea. Well, wind stirring up the great sea, that doesn't really clue us in totally yet, does it? About whether or not what we're looking at. But then we get into verse 3. And four great beasts came up from the sea, each different from the other. And as we go down, these are some terrible sounding beasts that we're going to see. But, not to get too far ahead of ourselves, the four winds of heaven, in literature this may can represent four points of the compass, four directions, but here it's a force stirring up the sea. And the great sea itself, we know it can represent the Mediterranean Sea, but here, that's not really what it's representing. If we skip over to verse 17, we get some help here with this. Those great beasts, which are four kings, which arise out of the earth. So it's arising out of the earth. So this is, so it tells right there that it's rising out of the earth or the mankind. So we know that much. So we know this can be representative of that in the passage. Once again, as we've talked about before, using the context. And here we've got somebody's representation of this. And as we'll see, these different beasts. And this, to me, I'm not sure this actually came from somebody who says the beasts, as I would say what each of these kind of represent. But that looked an awful lot like the Capitol building to me, that one on the far right. But anyway, here's these images of the four beasts coming up out of the sea. Okay. So the first beast, turn my face back. First was like a lion, this is verse 4. First was like a lion, and had eagle's wings. I watched till its wings were plucked off, and was lifted from the earth, and made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and a man's heart was given to him. So what do we know is some attributes of this first beast that he sees? It's like a lion. You think about it, a strong beast. It has eagle's wings. What, anybody know what maybe the eagle's wings could possibly represent? Well, actually, we actually see the two of these beasts have wings. It can mean swiftness. It tells us it flies like an eagle. But it also tells us that these wings were plucked off. So perhaps the advances of this beast or this team were checked at some point. And it also says was made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and a man's heart was given to it. So it was made comparatively weak, it was made vulnerable. And as we'll see later, it was eventually, the dominion was taken away from it. Okay. So, and as we're looking at this, we're kind of trying to look and see, you know, what are these attributes similar to? Who does this make us think of, hopefully? And like I said, obviously we've got the background of Daniel chapter 2, perhaps, but, you know, we don't want to kind of jump ahead. Let's just kind of see is this something similar or something totally different? Then verse 5. And suddenly another beast, a second, like a bear. It was raised up on one side and had 3 ribs in its mouth between its teeth. And they said thus to it, arise, devour much flesh. So this was a bear. What people are kind of noting of it, it says it was raised up on one side. When I first read this, I was thinking, you know, like if the bear's down on all fours and it's got like a shoulder up or something. And perhaps it represents, as we'll see, if this is representing the Medo-Persian Empire, that perhaps the Persian Empire being a little bit stronger, a little bit raised up. Or perhaps, kind of we're looking at it, if we see it in that way, in a little bit different direction, that it's the bear raising up. You know, like the bear raising up, showing itself, you know? And then you think of a big grizzly bear in the woods or something.
Ready to fight,
yes. And the rivers in its teeth. A couple different thoughts about what this possibly could reference to. I think the one that I've read perhaps a bit more most commonly that people think it might be is the Persian Empire being made up of really three parts as far as the core of the empire, or the core of it, the Persian, the Media, of course, and also Lydia. So perhaps it's representative of that. Also, perhaps somebody suggested that perhaps it represented three of the places they had conquered, Syria, Babylon, and Egypt, and as they were devouring this up into this empire. And of course, it was commanded, arise, devour much flesh, and it's following this other kingdom. So if we're looking at it and looking at a parallel of the four kingdoms that have already talked about previously, that here you have Babylon first, and now you've got the Medo-Persian Empire, perhaps. And then we look in verse 6. After this, I looked, and there was another, like a leopard, which had on its back four wings of a bird. The beast also had four heads. A dominion was given to it. Then we have a couple other things, and you know, once again, this is a very strange sounding beast. We've got this leopard with wings, and it's got four wings, representing perhaps swiftness. Perhaps representing swiftness, or lying, and this animal's cunning, lying away. It's interesting that it has four heads, because if this represents Greece, what it does, the Grecian Empire, after Alexander's fall, anybody you know from their ancient history what happened? Yeah, it fell into four generals. I remember a couple of their names, but I don't know if I can pronounce the other ones in the life, but I believe it was Ptolemy, Pergamon, Seleucid, and I can't remember how to say the other one, Pergamon, or something like that. Suffice it to say, oddly enough, how about that, the Greece fell whenever Alexander died, got split up into four southern powers, and was taken over by four of the generals. This beast has four heads. And it had dominion. And as far as the swiftness, the world thinks Alexander's empire is stretched out quickly was how quickly it took over some of these other empires, how quickly it took over land. So once again, we're seeing parallels to what we can actually see in history. And then the fourth beast. And I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, exceedingly strong. It had huge iron teeth. It was devouring, breaking in pieces, and trampling the residue with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. I was considering the horns, and there was another horn, a little one, coming up among them, before whom three of the first horns were plucked out by the roots. And there in this horn were eyes like the eagle, eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking pompous words. So this, you know, we aren't even really given like an animal that is described similar to. All we know is that this is something dreadful and terrible, and the picture we had it looking something like a dinosaur. Certainly something dreadful. And it was different from these other ones. It had iron teeth. Where have we seen iron before recently in this book? Right. Yeah. In the statue representing the Roman Empire. And it says that it's devouring, breaking into pieces, and trampling. In Daniel chapter 2, verse 40, describes it as crushing, I believe. Also notice it had 10 horns. And we know, if we go down to verse 12, for a moment, as for the rest of the beasts, they had their dominion taken away, yet their lives were prolonged for a season at a time. I got ahead of myself. And this beast was in the previous verse. I watched, second half of the verse, I watched till the beast was slain and its body destroyed and given to the burning fire. Okay, so we've had these four beasts, and as I've been alluding to, some of the similarities between the reality, what we know historically, and also what we saw in Daniel chapter 2. We've got a chart. sort of roughly reproduce something from something they've known to have, but this gives us kind of a comparison for us between Daniel chapter 2, chapter 7, and chapter 8, so we can kind of see how these line up. And see Babylon was the head of gold, and then in this chapter is the line of eagle's wings. Wings plucked off and given man's heart. Indo-Persian Empire, bonds and chest of silver. In this chapter is a bear raised up on one side, had the three ribs in its mouth, devoured. We'll actually see what in the next chapter as well. Another vision. Okay, Greece, belly of thighs and bronze, leopard, four wings of swift. And then we'll see this again as well. And of course, in the Roman Empire, we see there the legs of iron, oppression, rope, prance. This one had huge iron teeth, breaking, trampling, and it was different than these other ones, and it had 10 horns. As we'll get into, God's kingdom was a stone that took out these other ones. And this one will end up having, we'll talk about too, having dominion. So, perhaps one of the, and as we get through that, a lot of people may agree on what we've said so far, perhaps, with some of these things. But then it gets a little tricky when we're trying to consider these horns.
Don't horns stand for salvation?
In this context, I'm not sure, though.
I'm not sure either, but there's kind of a running.
Well, and we will be getting into here in a minute what it actually, where it goes into that. So let us consider, first of all, the ten horns. Skip over to verse 24. Let's see. We're told here, in verse 24, the ten horns are ten kings who shall arise from this kingdom, talking about the fourth kingdom, when he goes into the interpretation later. And it gives us more description about the other little horns. So, let's ask right there, are these ten horns, are they ten separate kingdoms? Or are they, what are they? Exactly, I think that's very important here in understanding this, and I think this is where some people go wrong from what some of the stuff I've read about this, because they try to construe this as ten new kingdoms coming out of this one, when it's ten kings. And yes, kings, we can talk about rising up as kingdoms. That's not what it's talking about here. It's part of this fourth beast, this Roman Empire. So I think the passage is pretty clear there. So then we get to this little horn, which is really kind of, as if the rest of this wasn't weird enough already, you know, we're getting into a horn that rises up. So here, verse 8. Verse 8, it rose up from these other ten horns. And also, these three others were plucked out before it. And had eyes. Eyes symbolizing, perhaps, you know, the having intelligence or this. And the fact, obviously, it's speaking. And what is it speaking, in verse 8? This great things, pompous words. Also, notice if we skip over verse 20, giving it the horns and the ten horns that were on its head, and the other horn which came up before which three fell, namely that horn which had eyes and a mouth, which spoke pompous words, whose appearance was greater than its fellows. Okay. So we're getting these little things that still kind of confusing to us, perhaps, trying to figure out what this is. It's got, as we're having this sort of bizarre image. Let's keep on reading what also this passage says about this horn so we can get, understand what everything's spoken of within the text. Verse 21. I was watching, and the same horn was making war against the saints and prevailing against them. So now we're getting a little more detailed. Whatever this is, whoever this is prevailing against the saints. And in verse 25, it's persecuting the saints. It's about the middle of the road, shall persecute the saints of the Most High. And of course, we see there that part about intending to change the times and laws. And the saints shall be given into his hand after that. Okay. So we've got this little horn, and we're trying to figure out what this could possibly represent. And this actually is a pretty difficult thing, and even to figure out exactly. We may be able to get the, I think getting the greater message of this chapter should be, if not straightforward, then we can get there with a little bit of study. But figuring out exactly what these 10 horns even are a bit of, leave a lot of discussion. Not the 10 horns, but the final horn especially. So there's really two views that I would accept
the right word.
But yeah, I mean, two views that are, I guess, most commonly held in church, too, that I would say we can give a lot of credence to. And they still come to the same point, perhaps, but they are different in how they, what they're actually stating. First of all, there's the literal view. So a view, we start off with 10 kings of the kingdom. But something we might ask, and we hopefully will get into later, are these, some would argue that these 10 kings have to be all at the same time, that whenever these kings happen, or these kingdoms, as some people argue, have happened all at the same time. Their initial kingdom. Do you think that's absolutely required by the text? No, not necessarily. This gets into something we talked about previously, about not putting requirements into something that isn't necessarily there. You know, if just something's left open, we need to leave it open until we can, clear it up for us. So this view, and I'll put this whole thing up here, I think. So this is one view, and there's a couple of different ways of looking at this, even within this idea of that these ten or literal 10 kings, plus the final one. Some would start out with that Pompey, who actually was not technically a Caesar. Yes, go ahead, I'm sorry. Good question? Oh, she's counting. Okay, gotcha. That's okay. Then we'll keep going. If something was confused me, the thing is, there a question up to this point? I'll probably answer. Hopefully, I'll answer it later. But if you got something now, I'd like to know it. That way, I can make sure I answer things as we go along. Okay. So, Pompey, they argue, was the first one, and he was basically sort of a default Caesar, and as part of the first triumvirate in the Roman Empire, or before it was, I guess, before it was an empire when it's still a republic. At least part of it, they had what is like a council. I'm not sure if the right word is. You should probably phrase this better, but basically there was three men that were in charge of this, and Pompey was one of these. And as they would go off to war, and later as Crassus died, Pompey was almost like default Caesar because he had so much power. And then they would argue these next several ones that I have listed here are going through with Vespasian, being the 11th one, or the little horn. And part of the reason they look at this, I think it's because as these inner wars and things were going on, as these empires were switching up, the emperors and Caesars were switching around, troops one joined the other, and another one joined the other, so effectively, it says the three were plucked out. Vespasian actually kind of fits this in a way because of the way these others were defeated and pulled away. Now, just to kind of throw everything out there, the problem that some people would throw with this particular arrangement is that Pompey wasn't technically a Caesar, but he was still, like I said, basically de facto. There's also some questions about possible dating, how this would work out with sometimes the New Testament. I'm not totally clear on how or why that is, but suffice it to say, there's some other possible ways of arranging this that people have suggested. Although the other one with the dating, the problem I saw with it was I don't think they give a real clear explanation about the three horns being plucked out, and this one seems to give the best explanation about how that would work out. And going along and continuing with the literal view of this, verse 25, kind of a little bit different, but also kind of tying the same line of thought the way we look at some part of this passage, literal or symbolic. verse 25 at the end of it says, then the saints shall be given into his hand for time and times and half a time. What I remember there would be that the time is a single year, perhaps. Times would be 2 years, and half would be half a year. Therefore, we have 3.5 years. And, as it turns out, when you're looking at this other arrangement, there's roughly 3.5 to 4 years between the Jewish revolt and the destruction of Jerusalem, and therefore you end up with about 3 years. So it actually, it would already work out with that as well. There's another view, and I believe this is the one that Mr. Harprider brings up, though, is more of a symbolic view. Now, with this, they would argue that a lot of this chapter is symbolic. It represents things, you know, it doesn't say the church. The chapter does not go through saying, here's this thing, obviously there's symbolism here, right? So they say, well, obviously some of it's symbolic. And they might argue, I'm not sure if he does here or if this is something else, that 10 can represent the government or human law or perhaps even completeness. And they would say the major problem with that previous, with the literal view, is that, you know, it's hard to say which kings are which. Which, you know, it may be hard to define that, but I think we can define it. It's just hard, there may be some disagreement over how exactly it works out. But they would argue, okay, so, and because of that, they would also argue, because the first emperor was Augustus, we can't make the seasons will work out, the 10 kings work out. Which is probably true, but that's once again going on the assumption that we can't consider somebody who's all-powerful or a default leader isn't actual leader. And as we know from our previous studies, a king can represent somebody who's not the supreme, necessarily, all, you know, the, what might say, the king. Okay. And so, well, it's not really a requirement to understand this passage. And, yes, we can understand the main points, get reach some of the same conclusions without this necessarily being literal, perhaps. And so, for this to work out, basically say, the little horn really represents a set of kings that represent during the period when the church was persecuted. And that this 3.5, they would say as well, that this is perhaps 3.5 number, but it's symbolic of a short period of time. 3.5, if 7 is a complete or perfect number, then 3.5 is a very incomplete number. It's half of a complete number or something, to that effect. Okay, so, and you can get into a whole lot of other strange, you know, beliefs and everything, but as far as ones that I think actually have some credence, I think both of these, you can get to at least the same conclusion when you are from this. What's that?
Just go on to the
Which what?
The ones that you just said. The last scene you said you mentioned, just go on to the
I'll tell you which way I would lean, which, because the problem with this, as I said, dark, unless you, is we have four kings, and also there's an issue going on with 10 kings representing a group of kings. I'm not necessarily saying that's wrong, but to me, I think I would give a slightly more credence to rule, although, like I said, I still have my own reservations to do the trouble deciding for myself. Which kings, and I mean, I've spent some time looking at this today, and I'm still about 4%. Yes?
You know,
it's called
names
and how
it's
unconsciously
it's
what's
going
And obviously you do have some of that mixed in it as well anyway. And what does that take away from looking at this as these four kings that come along, the persecution in the church, and ultimately the saints that, you know, went out? That doesn't take away from that. But, you know, I still think it's worthwhile to look at and to and to understand there are two different ways of looking at it. Either way, these two work. There's a lot of ways that you can look at this, which you've already kind of alluded to, that don't work with a passage whatsoever. Okay. So, then we move on. Okay, anybody want to raise any questions that I may or not be able to answer?
Why does it say, the great things he would say, that he would wear out the saints and be out of words against the king? That's the most common. Why? That's sick.
Which chapter?
That's 25. Yeah, 25.
Okay,
is that not? The Cedar says, is this not prophecy in some way that's supposed to just...
Well, absolutely. I mean, we're talking about, and as we're going to get into, as, you know, talking about the saints and the persecution of the church, I mean, when we're talking about the time of, you know, this early period of time, we're still looking at, you know, these empires are still long way off, as well as, you know, the end of the Roman Empire, or the time when the church would rise up. So, I mean, obviously, this is a prophecy, no doubt about that. Yes. And certainly, and there's, you know, there's so many little things in there, you know, some of these things we didn't even, I didn't even look at in particular, because, you know, we're looking at some things that helpfully lead us to some explanation to understand who these represent. You're right. I've known every single thing. You know, I think we should try, you know, to try to see if we understand anything we can, certainly. Especially when somebody brings forward, tries to sell the full out one on the spot and say this means, you know, something that wants to handle anything else. Also, we're going to be able to stop before we get that far by saying, we're going to contradict some of the other things about this complex. But I think it's always worthwhile for us to try to work through these things. And as best we can, seek to understand. And if we can't understand them, you know, then we just have to work and try to get, of course, not miss the big picture, though, certainly. I think that's certainly true. We've got to make sure we don't miss what this is really getting at. And of course, then we'll get to that as I'm quickly running out of time. But, okay, the next part of this is this vision of Ancient of Days. Let's read. Verses 9 through 14. I watched till thrones were put in place, and the Ancient of Days was seated. His garment was white as snow, and the hair of his head was like pure wool. His throne was fiery flame, its wheels a burning fire. A fiery stream issued and came forth from before him. 1,000,000 ministered to him. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court was seated, and the books were open. I watched them because of the sound of the pompous words which the horn was speaking. I watched till the beast was slain, and its body destroyed, and given to the burning flame. As for the rest of the beasts, they had their dominion taken away, yet their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. I was watching the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man, coming with the clouds of heaven, came to the Ancient of Days, and he brought him near before him. Then to him was given dominion, and glory, and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which shall not pass away. And his kingdom is the one who shall not be destroyed. So here we see this Ancient of Days, which is scripted with God. Thrones and the court. We're also giving this idea of judgment. Flaming fire. Vengeance. I'm getting ahead of myself. The light of the Ancient of Days being purity and righteousness. And there's thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of them and so on. And this is... I'll go with a quick mode, but point being these many hosts that are serving him and those that are before him. The Lord of hosts has used a couple hundred times in Isaiah and Jeremiah. And fourth beast is slain and body given this burning flame. Son of Man comes and his dominion does not pass away.
There's some block of light left in the middle of the room.
That's still another kind of parallel we can see here. We've really covered most of the interpretation pattern in this one, I guess, and for the sake of time, I won't go through a whole lot of this, but I want to go ahead and kind of skip down verse 26. But the court shall be seated, and they shall take away his dominion, whom will destroy it forever. In the kingdom and dominion, and the greatness of the kingdom is under the whole heaven,
and give to the people, the sons of the Most High, and his kingdom is an everlasting kingdom,
and all dominion shall serve and obey him. This is the end of the account. As for me, Daniel, my thoughts greatly troubled me, and my countenance changed. I kept the matter at heart. Obviously, we see judgment was executed, the kingdom was his everlasting possession, and we notice Daniel was greatly troubled, and not just that, but what does he do there at the very end? Get the matter to heart. Which I will tell you, I've been keeping this matter to heart. He's trying to study through this. But this chapter is very interesting, and obviously we haven't given it real time that we perhaps could. But I do want to hit perhaps a few conclusions for us that we can get out of this. Obviously this vision expands upon what we saw in Daniel chapter 2. And introduces a conflict and some things that we can see in Revelation. It depicts or further explains the establishment of the everlasting kingdom. We know that it occurred during the Roman Empire, and when Christ descended, we know this from the New Testament, and that they would experience a great persecution. So here we have this prophecy all the way this far back, looking forward to something just like we've seen before with prophecy, looking with often in great detail, and sometimes with very explicit explanations before things actually happen. And we know from this that saints are going to inherit the kingdom. And of course, as we've always, we know God rules over all, rules over this kingdom, both in earth and in heaven. And so, you know, as we try to get the message, try to get something out of this and all this difficulty with all these strange beasts and all this imagery, we can't miss the point that this obviously foretells. We've seen God's power do that, and of course we see God's power and his workings in the kingdoms of men. And I've got maybe a couple minutes left, so I don't want to go give a chance as far as or look at other questions, things that want to clear up real quick, perhaps. Any comments? Yep.
Satisfied with what we know already.
Yeah, certainly. But and of course, also notice he kept it apart. So obviously, he's thinking about these things. And I hope you will too, and that you'll consider these, because this chapter is used to go off on a whole bunch of different tangents. Very strong, you know, outside of a family here that if you haven't come upon, you probably will encounter it. Because this goes into all kinds of things with the Antichrist and everything else right from this passage, is, as that billboard said, that we see it even just driving down the road. So, next chapter, David Duncan will cover. So if you have any questions, you're thinking,